You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, Title 18 of the U.S. Federal Code, Crimes and Criminal Procedure, Part 1, Crimes, Chapter 29, Section 594. I'm throwing a few ellipses in here because there's a whole lot of, you know, things like District of Columbia, resident commissioner, etc. Whoever coerces any other person for the purpose of interfering with the right of such person to vote or to vote as he may choose or of causing such other person to vote for or not vote for any candidate of the office of president, vice president, member of senate, etc., shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for not more than 1 year or both. Now, let me repeat the first four words here. Whoever intimidates, threatens, coerces, or attempts to intimidate, threaten, or coerce. The Koch brothers sent a letter to 45,000 of their employees at Georgia Pacific saying, many of our more than 50,000 U.S. employees and contractors may suffer the consequences if we elect candidates who want to spend hundreds of billions in borrowed money, etc. The Backet also included an anti-Obama editorial by Charles Koch and a pro-Romney editorial by David Koch, another CEO threatening to fire employees if Obama wins. Again, 1 year in prison. Arthur Allen, AGS Software Solutions, he says, but I can tell you, if the U.S. reelects President Obama, our chances of staying independent are slim to none. I don't want to hear any complaints regarding the fallout that will most likely come. And on it goes. Is it time to send some CEOs to jail? David Keating, I suspect, thinks not. He's the president of the Center for Competitive Politics, the executive director of the Club for Growth, conservative organizations. I'm not sure. My dad was a conservative. I wouldn't even use the word conservative. Let's say, well, I'll let you describe it, David. Campaignfreedom.org is the website. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Well, we believe in free speech, basically. And we believe in your free speech and everyone else's free speech. And we think the First Amendment means what it says when it says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech.
So, but you don't believe in the free speech of workers in the workplace to say 50% of us want to form a union and speak in a single voice, just like the CEO is speaking in a single voice.
I didn't say that.
Well, you know, most would you?
Well, look, I definitely believe in the ability of people to get together and form groups, whether it's a union or some other organization.
So you're in favor of Karchuk. You're in favor of 50% of the employees of a company being able to say, yes, we want to have a union and a union coming into being.
No, I didn't say
okay,
that.
Okay, so your endorsement of free speech is qualified to that of CEOs.
No, not at all.
How can, if you're my employee and I hold economic power over you, and I suggest to you that if you vote the wrong way, you're going to lose your job, how is that free speech and not coercion?
Well, it's not coercion because they don't know how you're going to vote. We have the right to a secret ballot, and I think it's a great thing. So you can say whatever you want, but no one's going to be able to see how you vote. And I think that's one of the protections that we have.
So the people with the most money, in other words, in your worldview, the people with the most money have the most speech. The CEO has the speech to those people. But if any of those employees of Georgia Pacific were to send a letter to all of the employees of Georgia Pacific saying, we think David and Charles Koch are full of it, that, you know, if you look at the history of the last 60 years, during Democratic administrations, more jobs have been created than during Republican administrations. Simple fact, look it up. We're going to vote Democratic, it'll probably be a good thing for Koch Industries if you have a Democratic president in Congress. Don't you think that that person would get fired?
Well, I have no idea what the policies are there or not, but I would certainly support the right of those employees to send such literature to their fellow workers.
So you think that if somebody did that, you would want the force of law to protect them?
I don't think we need any force of law to protect them. Because
if David and Charles Koch were to fire these people, what would you do?
I think people should be able to send such speech anonymously to their fellow workers.
But David and Charles Koch didn't send it anonymously. So, again, you have a different set of standards for CEOs and for workers.
No, I'm not. I'm saying you're wondering about the ability of such a worker to send such information to fellow workers, and I support the right of that person to do that. I think one of the problems we have today is that it makes people afraid to do that because it's illegal to send such information anonymously through the mails.
What are you talking about?
It's illegal to urge people how to vote for a federal candidate and to do that anonymously. And I think these workers should be able to communicate with each other anonymously. And federal law does not protect that right today.
So
if they're
but you've done is you've reached down and found this little piece that's not relevant to this conversation, and you're holding that out as your argument. I'm saying that if the Koch brothers can say, hey, you know, if you don't vote this way, you might lose your job. Why can't an employee, not anonymously, identify themselves and say, no, I think we should be able to vote this way? But I'm guessing you would defend the Koch brothers' right to fire that person.
No, I wouldn't defend that. But
you would not.
I would not.
Would you defend that person? Do you think that there should be remedies at law to protect that person?
First of all, I don't think that's their policy at all. If you read the letter that they wrote to their employees, it specifically says it supports the right of employees to vote for whoever they want.
Well, of course, it was written by a lawyer.
Well, okay, but that's what it says.
But it's very clear. I mean, you know, this is very clearly an endorsement of Mitt Romney and going out to 45,000 Georgia Pacific employees. Those employees don't have the right, at least the best of my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, to speak back to the Koch brothers without fear of retribution because they're not unionized.
Well, that it depends. I mean, each state has its own employment laws, and some of these states may have employment laws to protect.
So are you supportive of employment laws that would support employees sending out a mass email or mailing to all of their federal employees? First of all, how would they even have access to the employee database, the list?
Obviously, many of them would not.
Okay, so again, we're back to the situation where the billionaires, the CEOs, they've got the power, they've got the list, they've got the means, the average worker doesn't. This is not a level playing field. This is an oligarchy. These guys are oligarchs.
Well,
what's wrong with democracy? Why are you guys supportive? I don't understand why, you know, campaignfreedom.org, why the Center for Competitive Politics is supportive of oligarchy in the United States. It seems to me like that's antithetical to the founding perspective of this country.
Well, it's not oligarchy.
How is it not oligarchy?
You're talking about coming up with many, many more laws to
oligarchy is a political system that is controlled or heavily influenced by those who are very wealthy. How can this not be oligarchy?
Because it's not the determining factor by any means. If it were oligarchy, the corporations would run things a lot more than they do today.
So if the Koch brothers don't think that they're doing this is going to have any outcome because it's not a determining factor by any means, then why are they doing it?
They're obviously
just like mental masturbation. They're just doing it for fun.
No, they're obviously doing it to try to exert some influence and suggest how they believe their employees.
Well, I believe you're contradicting yourself.
No, I'm not. That's the beauty of our system: is many people get to speak, many voices get to say what they believe,
especially the oligarchs.
And radio talk hosts and newspapers, there are many, many outlets. And that's the, I think, genius of our system for free speech, is a lot of people can talk and people can decide.
Okay. I'll leave you with the last word. David Keating, the president of the Center for Competitive Economics, executive director of the Club for Growth, campaignfreedom.org is his website. Check it out. David, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, should oligarchs be able to have influence on elections, or should we say, like with churches, you know, can't do that? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. So, you know, what should it be? John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, your thoughts on this?
Well, I just wanted to say I could possibly see companies monitoring what people do on, you know, at during the work time, but it also extends outside of work time to what they do on social media, so that they're monitoring that. And, you know, in the internet age and the electronic media, I mean, there's so much that they, if they really wanted to find out about you, like say they're pushing the Republican Party as the Koch brothers are, say you're involved in the, you know, Democratic Party, they could find reasons to fire you, and you would never know exactly why you were fired.
Right. If you're registered as a Democrat, that's a matter of public record.
Yeah, you could, you know, it is a matter of public record, I suppose, but they could hold, you know, they could fire you over that and just make it look, you know, they could trump up some reason. I think this is a terrible thing, but I also wanted to say that it brings up a larger problem to democracy in general, and that is the concentration of wealth is absolutely diametrically opposed to democracy, in the sense that it really does influence how, you know, things go as far as what is done within government. And, you know, I think that perhaps publicly funded elections might eliminate a lot of it, but also I just think that we need to have far more democracy, and we need to protect it, and it's not being protected by allowing such concentration of wealth in general.
No, I agree.
You know, our democracy directly, and people that say that it doesn't are just living in a fantasy land.
I'm with you. We have slid into oligarchy, and we're sliding faster
yes,
and faster,
you know,
into that, and I would even go so far as to call it kleptocracy. John, thanks for the call. Well said. Bill in Thompson, Ohio. Hey, Bill, what's up?
How you doing there, Tom? You know what I was thinking? What about coercion? If those people are influencing the vote at work, you're going to lose your job. Is there any way, to me it seems like they got an ongoing criminal enterprise. Is there any way we could prosecute these guys under RICO or anything to
Title 18, Part 1, Chapter 29, Section 594. It's titled Intimidation of Voters. Whoever coerces, can be imprisoned for not more than 1 year. That's the law, and that's the law that, frankly, I think should be applied. Bill, thanks for the call. John in Logsdon, Oregon. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, this is John. I was listening to the fellow earlier that was talking about the Koch brothers and they're wanting to lay people off or fire them if they voted wrong. Back in the 80s,
let me be very clear. They're not threatening individual workers. What they're saying is that a Democratic administration would adversely affect their business, and therefore they may either not grow or they may downscale. I mean, that's the clear implication of the letter. They're not saying, I know how you vote and I'm going to come after you. This is not a direct threat.
Well, back in the 80s, like I was saying, I was doing a reforestation program, planting trees and slash and whatever. Mm-hmm. But I knew for a fact what their ground looked like, and they didn't have a peelable stick left in the woods.
Are you talking about Koch Industries, Georgia Pacific?
I'm talking about Georgia Pacific.
Right.
When the union went on strike for wages, which was a long-coming thing, it took them about a year to get there,
mm-hmm,
they closed the mill and put it on a barge to Georgia, and they said it's labor's fault.
Right.
And it absolutely was not. They didn't, like I said, they did not have one peelable stick.
So they basically stripped out all the natural resources, and then they blamed it on labor.
And they didn't deal with federal timber.
Yeah.
Too many problems with the paperwork.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for the call, John. I appreciate it. John in Newport, Kentucky, it says you disagree with me. What's up?
Well, I work for Georgia Pacific, and I got that same package that everyone else got. And I think that any thoughts that there's any kind of retribution or any acts toward employees, which is the way it's being misconstrued by a lot of the media, is just
I think I was quite explicit just a moment ago. That's not what I was suggesting. But at individual and direct employees, but to 45,000 people, my concern is to the issue that David Keating was bringing up, which is free speech. The oligarchs in this country have incredible free speech. The Koch brothers that can speak to 45,000 people like that. And by the way, they can use the implied threat of loss of employment or diminution of employment as a cudgel, as a stick to beat people with, or suggest, as I said, implied. Whereas, can you as an employee, John, do that to the Koch brothers?
I guess I could. I mean, I probably wouldn't want to send them an email on this.
Yeah, I would think not. And that's...
I think that employers that have obviously a large investment, and even if they're a small company, would be foolish not to try to influence their employees in the way they vote and educate them. If they think that the policies of one candidate or another would be better for the long-term interests of the business or the employer, and I do.
But
think
what about the interests of the employees?
Pardon That's, me.
What about the interests of the employees? The interests of the employees are very often at odds with those of the interests of the employer or the business.
Executives and GP that openly support Democratic candidates, and I don't think there's any retribution in Koch in particular because they're in the crosshair so often. It's just really.
Yeah, I would expect they're probably quite careful.
Breaking the law. Pardon me?
I would expect that they're probably quite careful, and they follow the law very carefully.
They're extremely careful in any kind of government.
Don't we have, but my larger question is, don't we have a broken system where the oligarchs are constantly speaking politics, and the average person has basically, no voice other than the ability to cast a vote? I mean, John, thank you for the call. It seems to me like, the death of McCain-Feingold, the Citizens United decision, has just totally thrown us into oligarchy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's so amazing. The American media sits around and talks about the Russian oligarchs, these billionaires in Russia, and they do this and they do that. Nobody talks about the American oligarchs. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Wow. Hot topic here. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. This is what you said about Citizens United is absolutely creating an oligarchy is absolutely correct. But let's be clear about what free speech means under the First Amendment. It means that government may not infringe upon a person's free speech. But think of it this way, government may not, what does it say about religion, may not pass no law supporting or against a religion. But in Citizens United, government is supporting a group of industries or corporations that are becoming, that are infringing on people's free speech. So government is indirectly doing that.
Yeah, that would be my position. It's a subtle thing, or it's a little more nuanced thing, because free speech sounds wonderful, but if you want if dollars equals speech, which was basically the Buckley versus Vallejo decision back in the late 70s or early 80s, if dollars equals speech, then whoever has the most dollars has the most speech, and that is not frankly the American tradition. It's not the American way. That is how it works in banana republics, and that is what five right-wing wackadoodles on the Supreme Court have brought us, and that's what you can expect a lot more of if Mitt Romney gets to appoint the next two Supreme Court justices, which the next president will do. Mark my words.
Also,
so,
yeah, sure. So, and this also is, I think we mentioned before, is the way churches are becoming over-politically active.
Yes.
So by... if Congress may pass no law, but churches are also allowed to become endorse political.
Yeah, I say with regard to churches, let them say whatever they want from the pulpit. Just don't ask me to pay for their police and fire service. Don't try to be tax exempt. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Joe in Hanging Rock, Oklahoma. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Not much. What I wanted to say to you, can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
I worked for a company in Neenah, Wisconsin, back when George Bush was running for his second election.
Mm-hmm.
And in our letters we got with our paycheck, they did the same thing, telling us how we should vote for Mr. Bush.
Right.
I wrote him a letter back and told him that...
Him being the CEO?
Pardon?
Him being the CEO?
Yes, he owned N&M Transfer. He was the main owner.
Right.
The number one man.
Right.
And I wrote him a letter back telling him that if Bush serves another 4 years, that this country is going to be in big trouble. Of course, I was right, but I wasn't working there at the time to tell him, write him another letter and tell him that this is exactly what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of companies out there that put letters in your mail or whatever telling you that if you don't vote a certain way that they never threatened to fire us or anything, just saying that the business would go down, and it went down, but it wasn't because of who I voted for.
Yeah. Okay, Joe, thanks a lot for the call. From Joe to Joe, Joe in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was calling about public-funded elections here in the United States versus France. I lived in France for the last 3 years or during the Sarkozy elections. And as you said, our system is broken, but it's way beyond that because over there, they really came on. Their debates are totally formatted different, like Sarkozy and Ségolène Royal were sitting face-to-face discussing each of their topics. They were questioning each other directly on their policies. It was so much more really oriented for the public and about the people,
right,
where obviously you've stated many times here, this is really just about the rich. And I just wanted your comments on, how do we really change the system when the people in power here in the U.S. are the ones that have the ability to make the change, but yet
we have to either change the nature of or constrain the behavior of the principal institution of oligarchy in the United States, which is the U.S. Supreme Court. We can change the nature of it by having a Democratic president appoint the next couple of Supreme Court justices and swing that court from a 5-4 right wing to a 5-4 left wing or even centrist. There are no left wingers out there. And then they may undo some of the damage they've done. Or in terms of constraining them, I'd say go to movetoamend.org, move to amend, and sign up for the movement to amend the Constitution. They have chapters all over the country. You can start one. It doesn't cost anything. You can be a volunteer. You can show up. You can have meetings in your house, whatever. They've got an enormous amount of educational material. And let's get and we've got a whole bunch of members of Congress now who are saying, fine, let's amend the Constitution. Let's amend the Constitution to say that the Supreme Court cannot say that money is speech and that corporations are people. And the third way, of course, to do that, which I'm very skeptical about, would be for Congress themselves to exercise the power they have under Article 3, Section 2, to regulate the Supreme Court. I mean, it's right there in the Constitution, although that power has not ever really seriously been used. Abe Lincoln tried to use it. Franklin Roosevelt tried to use it. That's about it. But that's where I'd go with that. Thanks a lot for the call. Gary in Stevenson, Alabama. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm a truck driver, and over the past 12 months, I drive product from Georgia Pacific from time to time. And over this past year, I've noticed that I'm delivering their product to other paper distributors and printing companies that they are buying and putting their name on. And I think the big reason they want Romney in there is because I think they're afraid that Obama might enforce an antitrust law.
Makes perfect sense. And in fact, this Justice Department right now has two antitrust actions pending, two fairly major ones. And, although it's nothing like in Europe. Thanks a lot, Gary, for the call. Louise had her purse snatched over the weekend and lost her phone. So we went down and got the phone replaced. And guess what? You want to replace your iPhone with AT&T? It's $350. You got to buy the phone. But not only that, your contract rolls over for another 2 years and you get to pay hundreds of dollars a month for your contract. And this is not the big deal, huge contract. And in Europe, it's one-fifth of that cost. Why? Because the governments of Europe, and by the way, you can pick from dozens dozens, maybe hundreds, I don't know, but certainly dozens of different telephone carriers, you know, because they enforce their antitrust laws. This is not rocket science. So anyhow, I think this is something that we need to be, I digress slightly, but something that we need to be looking at. Michael in Defuniak Springs, Florida. Am I saying that right, Michael?
Yes, you are.
So what's up, Michael?
Well, at first, whenever I first started listening to you, then you were talking about the...
Okay, let's beep that, and thank you very much for the call. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Say, Frank, what's on your mind?
Yes, I want to talk about how recent this development on corporatism, parochialism has been. Mm-hmm. When I started working in high tech, this is in the high tech Northeast industry. When I started working, I worked for Wang.
Mm-hmm.
And United Way came around and gave us a presentation and with all kinds of envelopes to send money in. Dr. Wang sent a message around, a letter to each employee saying, this is entirely up to you. Do not back this, this type of endorsement at all.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to give, that's entirely up to you. God bless you. But I am not enforcing this at all.
Right.
20 years later, I was working for a company in Chelmsford, a small high-tech company, and the president came up and started talking about, where do you want to buy cheap goods? Walmart. And everybody went, yay! You know, and what he was trying to do was trying to enforce this idea of corporate. The company that he had $175 million in stash with Merrill Lynch at that time. This is in 2007.
This is the CEO of this company.
The CEO of this company. And he was standing in front of, maybe 5,500 employees.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about, and the next day, the AIG story broke out, and I was talking with this engineer, and a guy came up to us and started talking about some news on the Fox story about, Obama being a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I realized this is not, these people have so much money that they have infiltrated the minds of these people who are not listening. And I worked with a guy who I think is one of these guerrilla type of, Republican. No, not Republican, a right-wing nut.
Mm-hmm.
Who we go out to lunch, and he says, you should give up Social Security. You should give up unemployment.
Right.
You know, it's for the good.
Yeah,
the good
stand on your own 2 feet. You don't need no public education. We don't need no stinking public roads. Fire departments, to heck with them. I get it, Frank. And these people, they just don't, they don't think it through. Frank, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can get our free app over in the App Store. The Tom Hartman app works. It's all optimized now for the new really cool iPad as well as the iPhone. America. I just found this an amazing story. Those of you who listen regularly will recall that a week or so ago, I told you on the air this whole story of meeting David Friend, the guy who started Carbonite. Carbonite.com is their website. It's this product that backs up your computer automatically, no matter what you're doing, and to the Carbonite cloud, as it were, or Carbonite servers, and that he started. In fact, I think I told you the story. He started it because of his daughter going off to college and her computer was, getting crashed and things. And it's turned into this monster, and he had his technical support in India and brought it home. And I told you the story of that, but I thought that it would be really cool to get David on to tell you the story right, you know, from the horse's mouth, because he does such a better job than I did. David Friend is with us. He's the and let me disclose, Carbonite is an advertiser, a sponsor of this program, an underwriter for our nonprofit stations, a sponsor for our for-profit stations. But that's not why David's on here. David's on here because I think this is a story that every American should hear, and any American who is doing business in this country, who is thinking about sending their work overseas, should hear. And let me just preface this by pointing out, I mentioned earlier Louise had her purse snatched over the weekend, and or lost or whatever, and I called the credit card company, one of the major banks, and I got a guy in India. And who, you know, when I asked, he told me he was in India, and he took all the information, and he had all of her information. India right now, as a country, is debating in their parliament whether or not to pass a law making it a crime. It is not yet a crime. Making it a crime for the person working at that call center for that big bank to write down Louise's name, write down her social security number, write down her credit card number, write down her address, write down anything they want, any information she gives them, put it in his pocket, and then after he gets off the shift, walk out on the street and sell it to somebody. There's a lively business in India of this stuff, and they are literally debating right now whether or not to make that illegal. It is illegal in the United States. David Friend with Carbonite.com. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
It's great talking with you. So you tried India. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, like a lot of high-tech companies, you know, we started with outsourcing our customer support to India. And, you know, as you know, Carbonite's grown to be a pretty big company. And, you know, at one point, a year and a half or so ago, I was getting frustrated with not getting really the best feedback from our customers on this. And I said, look, backup is a very important thing. You know, when people lose their wedding pictures or their business records or something like that, you know, they want to feel like they're being taken care of in the very best possible way and that the information is, you know, going to be treated properly. And so I said, I don't care how much it costs us. You know, I just want to bring all of this back to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So we opened up a center in Maine. We have about 220 people there now. And we have completely repatriated all of those jobs to the U.S. And I have to say, it's just been an incredible success.
Now, David, you know, if we were to listen to the advocates of globalism and all this kind of stuff, the Tom Friedmans of the world, you must be going broke right now, paying those American workers all that money when people in India will do this for a buck an hour.
Well, you know, I was prepared for it to cost more, and at that point I didn't really care because I knew we had to do this because it was the right thing to do for our customers. And in fact, we do pay people in Maine probably three or four times as much on an hourly basis than we do people in India. But the interesting thing, and the reason I get so many calls about our experience here, is it's actually not costing us any more to do customer support in Maine than it was in India, because the 20-minute phone call to India turns into a 5-minute phone call to Maine. And
wow.
So it's just, you know, financially, not only are we getting, like, you know, hugely positive experiences from our customers, but it's actually not costing us anymore. So it's just been, you know, it's been an incredibly positive experience.
So even though you were ready for a reduction in corporate profits, this actually has been a, from that point of view, this has been a good business decision. What about, you know, the India outsourcing centers? I get solicitations from them from time to time. We don't outsource anything here, but I mean, we don't have tech support, but you know, I suppose we do with our message board. But I get these solicitations and they say, oh, we've got, you know, highly trained people and, you know, they do a great job and all this kind of thing. What's your customer satisfaction? How is that? Where was that in India and where is it now?
Well, you know, after every customer support call, we do survey people and we say, you know, how did you like it? And you have 1 to 5, 1 being, I didn't like it, 5 being great. And top 2 box score in India was about 30%, and in Maine it's about 95%.
Wow.
So, you know, one of the problems was there was a lot of turnover in India. And, you know, we'd get somebody trained up and then they'd go across the street and get a 5-cent an hour raise and be gone. And, you know, that just, you can't do really good customer support if your workforce isn't stable. And up in Lewiston, Maine, There are 9 colleges within 15 minutes of our office up there. So we get really smart people out of Bowdoin and Bates and the University of Maine and all these other really good colleges up there. And they like living in Maine. It's a great lifestyle. It's a beautiful state. And they've been very welcoming to us up there. And you know, the whole experience has just been positive beyond my wildest dreams.
So with American employees, you don't have the turnover problem that you had with Indian employees?
No, and they see it as a career path, and lots of them get promoted up to more responsible positions as the company grows. And they're a 2-hour drive up the road. So, you know, they can come here to headquarters.
You mean from your corporate headquarters in Boston, right.
And I can get in the car and be up there in a couple hours if, you know, if I want to go up and visit all our employees in Maine. So, you know, it's just, it's much better. And, I get a lot of calls from other companies who are thinking about this. And you know, even if their experiences were only half as good as ours, it would still be a real positive thing to do.
Yeah, it sounds like this is a transportable thing. You are leading the charge. Good work. David Friend, the president of Carbonite, or the CEO of Carbonite. David, thank you for dropping by and sharing your story in your own words.
Yeah, pleasure, Tom.
It's great talking with you. And thanks for supporting our show, by the way. Appreciate that, too. David Friend, Carbonite.com. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. I want to follow up on that conversation I had with David Friend just a few minutes ago of Carbonite. Their experience bringing their employees back, or their customer service back from India into the United States. So it's now an entirely American company. There's a flip side trend. You know, there's a big problem when foreign investors are buying up schools here in America, so they, instead of we the people, can educate our young people. Yet that's exactly what's happening. As Alyssa Figueroa is reporting over at Alternet, wealthy foreign investors are taking advantage of our immigration laws by investing millions in charter schools. You see, there's this thing called the Immigrant Investor Program, which gives you a green card to foreign investors as long as they invest at least $1 million in the U.S. economy and create at least 10 full-time jobs. So the business of choice to invest in? Private, for-profit charter schools. So far, just Chinese investors have spent $30 million buying charter schools in Florida alone. And according to a new report from Miami Today, they plan to invest nearly $100 million next year. Think about that. Foreign investors buying the rights to teach American students with guaranteed profits from our tax dollars. That's because this is all because we buy more from the rest of the world than we sell to them. It's the predicted consequence of our bizarre free trade policies that leads to a trade deficit of $800 billion every year. That's $800 billion more that ends up in the hands of foreign investors who have to spend that money somehow. So they spend it buying up our commons, like our schools. Of course, buying for-profit schools is the new business model for more and more billionaire investors here in the United States, too. We've seen a slew of Hollywood movies come out recently, bankrolled by billionaires praising the for-profit school model. There was Waiting for Superman, the most recent one, Won't Back Down, flopped at the box office, but expect the Hollywood investments in privatizing education to continue as long as there's billionaire money to make it happen. Republican lawmakers are doing the work of these investors and chopping away at our public school system to eventually replace it with a private for-profit school system. And who knows? I mean, maybe if the, you know, if the Saudis get in on this, I really don't think that, you know, the Chinese-owned charter schools are going to do anything other than make money for their investors. There's not a, you know, a big ideology that they're pushing, to the best of my knowledge, in China. In fact, they're going through a lot of changes. But, you know, the second largest investor in Fox News is Prince Al Talal, I believe his name is. He's the guy who tried to give $10,000 to New York City after 9/11, or maybe it was $10 million, it was ten something. And Giuliani said, "No thanks, we don't want your money." He's the guy who is helping fund the so-called 9/11 mosque. Member of the Saudi royal family. He's the second largest owner of Fox so-called News. Think about that next time, you right-wingers. So what would happen if Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, if Iran, or if the Taliban in Pakistan were to say, hey, you know, we got a few extra $1 million kicking around here. Pakistan gets $3 billion a year, I believe, in foreign aid. We'll take $1 billion and buy American schools and start teaching. You know, Pakistan, I don't think that this is so much the case, but in Saudi Arabia, there are actually textbooks that say that, for example, Jews eat the blood of Gentiles in their holy holidays. What if they just started throwing that in the textbooks here? You know, in Florida, Republican Governor Rick Scott wants to double charter school enrollment in his state over the next 6 years. And in Chicago, one of the main reasons the teachers union went on strike was because of Mayor Rahm Emanuel's plans to open 60 new charter schools in that city, which would be staffed with low-wage, non-unionized teachers. But here's the main thing you need to know about for-profit schools. They don't offer any better results than public schools, and they cost more. As a 2009 study from Stanford showed, more than half of all charter schools examined did not offer any better educational results than public schools, despite costing parents and taxpayers a lot more money. In fact, 37% of the charter schools examined offered significantly worse learning results than their public school counterparts. When was the last time you heard that on national news? But the billionaires and the foreign investors, they don't care about learning results. They care about profits, just like the corporate media. And it's a pretty lucrative industry because education is recession-proof. The state is a large consumer of the product, and there's no shortage of kids who need to be schooled. That's a pretty damn solid business model. And it's why more and more investors are getting into the game, including foreign ones. But lost in all this talk about the money is the talk of what this does to our nation. What are the consequences for our democracy if the next generation of American children are educated by foreign investors? We're already seeing what happens in our media when it's partly owned by foreign investors. As I mentioned, you ever heard of the name Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal? No? Well, he's the really rich Saudi prince who offered Rudy Giuliani a huge donation for New York City after 9/11 that Giuliani turned down and went on to help fund the so-called 9/11 mosque in downtown Manhattan, which, by the way, I have defended from day one. But you would think that, you know, Fox getting so hysterical about that, Fox so-called news, they'd be all over that, right? Wrong. Because Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal just so happens to be the second largest shareholder of voting stock in News Corp, which owns Fox so-called news. So for all you Fox so-called news viewers who think you're receiving fair and balanced coverage of the news, you're actually receiving news from a Saudi prince. And now we want to turn our schools over to these same sorts of investors? We can't let this happen. The education of our citizens, as Thomas Jefferson so eloquently and repeatedly pointed out, the reason why he started the University of Virginia, Abraham Lincoln believed the same thing, the reason why he took millions of acres of government-owned land and gave it out as for the land-grant colleges, for free colleges. The education of our citizens is the linchpin of our democracy, and it would be national suicide to outsource that linchpin to the highest foreign bidder, be it Chinese, Saudi, or Canadian. Educating our young people should be left up to we Americans, to we the people, through our government, via our commons. It should not be left up to a handful of billionaires, both at home and abroad, who are mostly just trying to make a buck, but may also have some interest in what's covered in the news and taught in our schools. It's time to stand up to the privatization of our schools now. People don't get this. This is a big deal. Plato, 3,000 years ago, Plato said, He who controls the stories of a society controls the society. Where do we learn those stories? In our schools. And increasingly, our schools are being run by people who are doing them based on the profit motive. Now, what do you think they're going to teach in those schools about the commons? Do you think that a for-profit school is going to talk about the importance of having a not-for-profit commons? Of having water and electricity, you know, any of the natural monopolies. You can't have three different water companies run water lines into your house. You can't have three different electric companies burn cable into your, you know, power cables into your house. Do you think any of those for-profit schools are going to be talking about the commons? Do you think that there's going to be a vibrant, robust discussion of public education or the history of public education in the United States? Somehow I doubt it. This is symptomatic. You know, there's two big things here that this is symptomatic of. One is that 35 years of insane international trade policies have left trillions of dollars outside the United States as a result of all our trade deficits. We used to have trade surpluses. First 200 years of the history of this country. Now we have trade deficits. So all that money is outside the United States, and these other countries, they have to figure out how to spend it. Oh, let's buy some American schools.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And then let's put some of our books in those schools, and let's have the American kids learn what we want them to learn. Really? Okay, tomorrow night is going to be the second presidential debate, the third in the series, the first with the president and then the governor, the second with trying to think of some cute, the second with Vice President and Congressman Ryan, Vice President Biden tomorrow is going to be the president and the governor again. And Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois, United States Senator from Illinois, Senate Majority Whip, BarackObama.com, of course, the website for the Obama campaign, is on the line with us. Senator Durbin, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be with you, Tom. How are things going?
Very, very well, thank you. And I hope they are going well for you. I'm curious your thoughts on the real Mitt Romney. I'm still trying to, you know, this guy is changing his position more frequently than a yoga instructor.
Well, I tell you, I was in Cleveland Saturday night campaigning for Sherrod Brown and the president, and they told me it was the home of Etch-a-Sketch.
Yes,
but
it is.
Unfortunately, the company has closed down. They moved, I guess, overseas. And it just reminded me of that moment in the campaign when one of Romney's advisors said, you know, when the primaries are over, we're going to lift the page like Etch-a-Sketch. Oh, there was this big sharp denial and all the rest of it. But if you watch that first debate, that's about what happened.
Right.
I mean, when they, you know, the president said $5 trillion tax cut, and Romney was shocked, like he'd never heard the term before.
Right.
And the fact is, he not only heard it, but he made it up as part of his campaign. I was kind of surprised. He's trying to race to the middle, be moderate, look a little bit different than he did during the course of the Republican primaries.
Well, it has apparently worked for him his whole life. I mean, being a salesman, particularly in the securities business, we don't see the very best track record. I'm sure you're familiar with the hearings where Senator Levin was dropping obscenities, quoting from the emails of the various securities traders. I mean, the industry that Mitt Romney came out of is an industry in which you basically say anything to make the sale or to get the company. And his political history is the same too. He has been on every side of every issue. How does the Democratic Party, how does the president, how does a debater, how does anybody deal with somebody who is a serial liar's not even the right word. It's like, you know, he has no internal compass as far as I can tell.
Tom, I can remember as sure as I'm sitting here at this moment, a conversation I had with Ted Kennedy before he passed away. In fact, many years before he passed away, he said that as whip, I had to try to arrange the votes in the Senate so he could leave and be up in Boston. He had to be there with Governor Romney to sign the health care bill in Massachusetts. He had helped
right.
him. He'd worked on it.
Romney here.
Yeah, Romney did. And Kennedy wanted to be there with him, and he was with him on the signing of the bill. And I think about that every time I watch Romney deny that he had anything to do with it or that he embraces the basic principles of it.
Right.
And I just wonder, how do you do that? How can you make such a dramatic change on some things that are very fundamental, like health care and education and basically the tax program that he pushed for as conservative Republican? I think America's voters have the right to ask these hard questions. The president, I think, was a little reserved in his approach to the first debate.
Just a little.
Tomorrow night's a lot different.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that tomorrow night's a lot different. I thought Joe Biden did a great job of taking names and kicking butt. And
hey, Tom, you know what the giveaway was on that one?
What's that?
That the Romney Ryan campaign called Martha Raddatz ahead of time and asked her, would they please refer to him as Mr. Ryan, not Congressman Ryan? Now, that tells the whole story. He does not want to be associated with the John Boehner Tea Party Republicans. He knows what a negative that is.
Right.
And Martha Raddatz, and good for her, said no. He's a congressman. I'll refer to Joe Biden as vice president. And that's what she did during the course of the debate. But it just shows you how they're trying to reinvent themselves during the course of these closing days.
And it seems to me that this is... You know, I've been watching politics for a long time. I'm, you know, at the risk of revealing my age here. When I was 14 years old, or 13 years old, 1964, I went door to door for Barry Goldwater with my dad. 3 years later, I was, you know, getting arrested in East Lansing in an SDS anti-war demonstration. So my politics have changed a lot since the 64 election. But they've stayed consistent since 68, I'll add. But I don't, in my political life, and I remember Eisenhower. I mean, I was a little kid, but my dad was a very, very active local Republican, fellow. And in fact, died a Republican. I mean, we debated politics our whole, you know, his whole life. I don't recall any campaign in my lifetime, which is over a half a century, that has involved a candidate who has changed positions so nakedly, so with such facility, with you know, a smile on his face, without even acting embarrassed. I mean, even Richard Nixon, if he did something like this, would show some embarrassment. Am I exaggerating this, Senator Durbin?
No, I don't think you are. And you know, Nixon's a good illustration. You and I'm a little older than you are, but Richard Nixon and his involvement in the Vietnam War and the like, notwithstanding, when it came to domestic policies, Nixon was a very moderate Republican.
Yeah.
I mean, you look back on creation of the EPA under his watch, federal revenue sharing under his watch, things that occurred that were considered to be responsible policies. Even Ronald Reagan, for goodness sakes, was the author of and proud of the Earned Income Tax Credit
right.
to help working families get by. Where is this Republican Party today? When I saw Lincoln Chafee, the governor from the state of Rhode Island, come and speak to us at the convention, Democratic convention. He basically said, this is not the Republican Party that I grew up in. Grew up, of course, son of John Chafee, one of the more outstanding senators I've had the honor to serve with. This Republican Party made such a sharp right turn, and let me tell you, in the front seat, cheering them on all the way, was Mitt Romney. Now he's trying to tell us, take it all back. Don't really mean it. I think that's a hard sell.
Yeah. Have you ever been in a debate? I'm sorry, we're out of time. The damn machine starts, and I have no control over it. Senator Dick Durbin, BarackObama.com, of course, the Obama website, U.S. Senator from Illinois and Senate Majority Whip. Senator, it's always an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for dropping by.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. We will be right back. 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we will be giving away a copy of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country, autographed by the author, that's me, sometime this show. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The real Mitt Romney?
Oh, let's see. He's opposed to Roe v. Wade. He's in favor of Roe v. Wade. He's opposed to $5 trillion in tax breaks. He's in favor of $5 trillion in tax breaks. He's opposed to Obamacare. He's in favor of Obamacare. This is a man with no political center, no core. That frankly concerns me more than anything else. I at least knew that George W. Bush was basically a warmonger who wanted to take us into war and who, you know, wanted to represent the fat cats. And, you know, you knew who he was. You know, 1977, 78, as I recall, he ran for Congress on a platform of privatizing Social Security. George W. Bush from Texas. He lost. But, you know, he tried, and he tried it again in 2005. He was consistent. You pretty much knew where Ronald Reagan stood. You knew where Bush Sr. stood. You knew where Bill Clinton stood. Or sat. You knew. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson. I was talking with Harry Reid over the weekend. And he said that, and I'm paraphrasing from memory, and my apologies to Senator Reid if I have this wrong, but I don't think I do. The exact number I know I do have wrong, so I'm just going to give you an approximation. But he said that in the next month or two or three, he will have been the Senate Majority Leader for the exact same number of years as Lyndon Johnson was. Lyndon Johnson was, you know, the senator from Texas, and then, you know, ran in 1960 as the vice presidential nominee along with Jack Kennedy and won, and that was the end of his Senate career. But he had been, at that point, the leader of the United States Senate for 6 years, 54 to 60. This was part of the most contentious period in the history of the United States. And Lyndon Johnson was, you know, the guy running the Senate, running the agenda, deciding what's going to be done, when, where, all that kind of stuff. So anyhow, Harry Reid says, in the 6 years that he's been running the Senate, he's had to deal with, and he threw a number out, and my recollection is it was 367. I could be off by 10, 20. You know, it might have been 376 or 387 or something like that, but it was over 300. Filibusters. Republican filibusters. And he said, do you know how many filibusters Lyndon Johnson dealt with in the exact same six-year period when he was the head of the Senate? And he was a Democrat, too? One. I mean, the Vietnam War was going, the movement, it hadn't started at that point. This was in the late 50s, but the women's movement was starting up. The civil rights, this is following Brown v. Board of Education in 54. In fact, that would be the year that Lyndon Johnson took control of the Senate. This was, the lead up to Roe v. There's so much going on. One filibuster. These Republicans are, I don't think of the Republican Party anymore as a political party. They're hiring criminals to change the voting poll rolls. Their secretaries of state are stripping people off the voting rolls. We had Greg Palestine. He was talking about how down in Florida, they've knocked over 80,000 people off the rolls simply because they have BLA after their name. They're black. I mean, they got excuses. But that's really what's going on. And it's happening not just there in Colorado, hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, there's lots of people all around the country who are going to show up and try and vote in a couple of weeks, or early voting even now, and be told, sorry, I don't see your name here. You can fill out this provisional ballot if you want, but by the way, they never get opened. Unless there's an audit. Unless there's a battle at the last minute. I think of the Republican Party more as an organized crime syndicate. It's behaving like the mafia. Power at any cost. Yeah, I've got to kill a few people. You know, both Paul Krugman and Nick Kristof, brilliant pieces in the New York Times in the last couple of days about how Mitt Romney's health care policies would cause people to die. You think when I say, oh, yeah, I kill a few people, I'm exaggerating? No, I'm not.
cause people to die. It's pretty amazing. Kay in Rockford, Illinois. Hey, Kay, thanks for calling. What's up?
Yes, sorry if there's a lot of background noise. In reference to the letter in with Coke and us, I have just the opposite situation at work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are a government entity, at least in my, you know, in my offices, thousands of offices. But our union has actually had sent a letter, periodical that's politically correct. And they highly recommend that we do not have anything on our person, remove anything on our vehicle, do not talk about anything. Because some people are very strong-willed.
In other words, your government employees union is basically saying, don't break the law.
Correct, you know? Yes.
Right. Well, good on them.
Exactly. And, you know, and it's been, there's been a couple of people that tried to start a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then squelched by management because it can get into a knockout, dragout fight because some people are very, very strong-willed.
Yeah.
And they said it distracts from the work. Everyone has their opinions, and it's just that we can't advertise it on our person. And when we're in the parking lot, we have to remove anything from our vehicles as well.
Yeah. Well, good on them. Now, of course, the important note here to make is that there are different rules for government employees than there are for private employees, or mostly for government workplaces. Members of Congress, for example, when they need to raise money, they have to leave their Senate or House office building. And, in fact, in the building that we're broadcasting from here, we're about four blocks away from the Congress, from the Capitol building, in the elevator from time to time, you're Senator so-and-so. Actually, I don't say it. You know, you just recognize them, you know, senators and Congress, members of Congress who have offices here so that they can sit and, you know, dial for dollars. And it's tragic that it has to be that way, but they have to go out on private property to do it. So excellent point, Kay. Thank you. Thanks for sharing it. Damien in New York City. Hey, Damien, you wanted to defend the Koch brothers?
No.
Really?
What I'm trying to say is that with any business, if the Koch brothers, for whatever reason, any of the business for that matter,
mm-hmm.
if there are policies that the companies are facing, that are government policies, such as, say, the Affordable Care Act, say, or if...
Well, the Affordable Care Act is going to actually make it cheaper for healthcare for American companies.
Well,
that's not a good example.
Let's
take the example of, you know, Georgia Pacific having to clean up the poisonous chemicals that they're dumping into the air and water and, the EPA regulations. They want to do away with those.
Can I finish my point?
Yeah.
What I mean is that if a company is, you know, in the incumbent, say, or whatever presidential candidate is saying that we're going to raise taxes, we're going to implement a policy that may raise our costs. Well, I think it's kind of responsible then for a company to let their employees know that this might cut into our bottom line, and if that happens, hey, we may have to make cuts in personnel. So it's kind of like a gray area, but, I mean, would you rather get a pink slip without knowing ahead of time that, you know what, shoot, I didn't realize that these policies would have an adverse effect.
No, and Damien, I'm not suggesting that companies should be forbidden from doing this. What I'm suggesting is that employees should have an equal voice. By coincidence, virtually all of these companies that are doing this have worked very, very hard and have spent millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, in some cases billions of dollars, to prevent their employees from unionizing.
You know what, Tom? Here's the reality, right? When a company forms, no one, I don't care who it is, I don't care if they're red or blue, no one is saying, I can't wait to start making people money. I can't wait to start giving people health care. People form companies because they say, I want to make money. And that's the bottom line. I think a lot of people, unfortunately, like yourself, think, well, wait a minute, the company's there to make employees.
You know,
money.
Damien, I have been running businesses since 1972. I've not had an employer since 1972. I've been my own boss. I've started a series, I believe, seven businesses, built up and sold off five of them very successfully. I've retired five times and then decided after a year or so, gone back into business. Let me finish. In every single case, I have provided my employees with health care,
We owned a travel agency in Atlanta. Not only did we do that, but we even put a daycare center inside our travel agency. And during the first 2 years that we did that, Louise and I took no pay. And we were providing those benefits to our employees. During the first 2 years of this radio show, we were providing benefits to our employees. We took no pay. Typically, entrepreneurs in the first year or two of a company, you know, you're not making money. You're just breaking even. But if you don't treat your people right, in my opinion, and frankly, I know I'm not just, you know, the crazy liberal on this. I know a lot of small business people who feel the same way. If you can't treat your employees well, if you can't be a decent member of the community, particularly with a small business where you've got to answer to the neighbors and everybody else, if you can't treat your employees well, you have no right being in business. You just absolutely have no right being in business. And that's why I think that, for example, the minimum wage should be, you know, at least $12 or $13, $15 an hour, whatever. It needs to go up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Let's start with 10. Let's at least take the minimum wage to $10. It'd be the biggest economic stimulus this country could get. And then give everybody health care. It works for other countries.
Ain't that good news?
Man, is it good news? It's the news. Anyway, this Talk Radio News Service report is brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org or donsiegelman.org. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria, what's going on?
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in the world?
Well, as you know, the presidential debate, the town hall format at Hofstra University is tomorrow night at 9 Eastern. And there's a bit of a kerfuffle going on about the moderator, Candy Crowley, and the role she's going to play. Will it be that of a potted plant or will it be that of an active moderator? She says the latter. And the two camps, the Romney and Obama camps, apparently were not happy about that. Now, Obama's people have just tweeted that he is more than happy to take questions from anybody, whether it be questioners or her. And so apparently he's on board with this. But she insisting in interviews that she will follow up.
Yeah, but the Romney camp is quite upset about it. Now, when Jim Lehrer played the role of potted plant, and what was her name? Who did Martha Raddatz?
Martha Raddatz,
who did the vice presidential debate. She played the role of an actual moderator and interacted with the people. The potted plant one didn't work out so well for the Democrats. The active moderator one worked out quite well for work out so well for the Republicans. So I can see why the Republicans would say, "We want another potted plant, please."
Exactly. Well, the latest is that at Times, Mark Halperin has now leaked the 2012 Memorandum of Understanding between the Obama and Romney campaigns.
Right.
It's 21 pages.
And does it say anything that we need to know about?
Well, it has some nuggets in it. Mm-hmm. I haven't had time to go through the whole thing yet, but it does say that the two candidates are not allowed to ask each other direct questions.
Right.
It says that they're not allowed to make pledges.
Read my lips.
Right. It also says, as far as this particular debate, her role is she will not rephrase the question or open a new topic. The moderator will not ask follow-up questions on comment on either the questions asked by the audience or the answers of the candidates during the debate, or otherwise intervene in the debate, except to acknowledge the questioners from the audience or enforce the time limits and invite candidate comments during the two-minute response period.
So the rules require her to be a potted plant.
She didn't sign.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yes.
So this is just what the Romney and Obama camps agreed on, but she didn't say, yes, I'll sign up for the potted plant role.
No.
That's fascinating. Well, it's going to be an interesting evening tomorrow night. What else is going on?
I think so. Going to be quite lively. The Supreme Court has decided to take up an Arizona voter law over whether Arizona can require proof of citizenship when people register to vote.
Right.
Now, the case isn't going to affect this election on November the 6th. The requirement had been blocked by a lower court, and the arguments won't take place until after Election Day. But it could further set the lines between state and federal control over election procedures.
Here's what amazes me about this, Victoria. If you are not a citizen of the United States and you vote in a U.S. election, you can go to prison for 3 to 5 years, depending on the state or whether you're prosecuted under federal law. I mean, you can do serious, hard time. If you walk into Macy's and, walk out with a $200 brooch in your hand or in your pocket, you can also go to jail for 3 to 5 years. It doesn't happen that much. I mean, you know, shoplifting is a problem, obviously, but it doesn't happen that much because there's a law against it. There's a law against illegally voting. At least if you steal something from Macy's, not to pick on Macy's, they just happen to be down the street, so it popped in my mind. You've got, if you get away with it, you've got the brooch. If you illegally vote in an election, what possible benefit does it inure to you? None. Nobody. Who's going to do this?
Well, I think that's the interesting question. Who's going to do this?
Yeah, the history shows that the vast majority of people who are, quote, committing voter fraud are either people like Ann Coulter, who registered at her agent's address to vote because she didn't want to give out her personal address, something that, you know, people like you and me in the media can understand, although we don't do it. I'm assuming you don't. I don't. Or somebody like Mitt Romney, who lived in his mansion in California but registered himself in his son's unfinished basement in Massachusetts so that he could vote against Ted Kennedy, arguably voter fraud. Or the most common is people who are ex-felons in states that don't allow ex-felons to vote who didn't realize that. And when they do realize it, they're scared to death because that's a violation of their parole. They go back to jail. I mean, again, who's going to do this?
Not very many people.
Yeah. More people last year died from having their televisions fall on their heads than were arrested or for voting fraud.
Did you make that up?
No, I didn't. 33 people were arrested for voting fraud last year or the year before, and 36 people died from having televisions fall on them.
Somebody compiled that. You know that, don't you?
I assume so, yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yes. So, what else is up?
Other piece of information. We don't have much time, so I'll give you some light news. Mitt Romney, in the 47% video, he was very critical of the television show The View, where he referred to sharp-tongued women.
Uh-oh. So, therefore, he's supposed to go on The View with his wife, isn't he?
That's correct, yes. He's canceled.
Oh. Surprise,
Anne will appear, but he actually had a scheduling problem.
Yes, suddenly. He had a dentist appointment, right?
Well, we don't know what it is. It's unknown, but he won't be able to appear. Barbara Walters graciously said today he can change his mind, and we hope he does.
Yeah.
It would be our pleasure to have him on the program.
Yeah, and actually, I'm sure that they'd treat him quite respectfully. I mean,
he's a
candidate for president of the United States. They're not going to beat him up. Remarkable. Well, you know, he's taking the very safe approach. He's now ahead, according to some polls. And so his big thing now is to avoid mistakes, whereas when you're behind, you take chances. So this doesn't surprise me. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Brought to you by free-don.org. Check it out.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. You need to know this. Slowly but surely, the United States of America is being eaten alive by foreign transnational corporations. For example, today, top story in Financial Times. I'm assuming above the fold. Since we moved out of our apartment and into this boat out here, I no longer get the physical newspaper, but I get it online, and it was a top story on the Financial Times website. News broke that telecom giant Sprint is being bought by the foreign Japanese corporation SoftBank for more than $20 billion. granted the deal, which is the largest American acquisition by a Japanese company in history. 70% of Sprint will now be owned by overseas investors. This deal is going to most likely be approved next year. I mean, you know, which is only a few months away, making SoftBank Sprint the third largest mobile phone company in the world. Not only that, this deal is going to suck billions in future revenue and profits out of the American economy and into Japan. It's already the case with the nation's fourth largest mobile phone company, T-Mobile. Did you know who owns T-Mobile? It's Deutsche Telekom. AG. Aschel Gemeinschaft, as I recall. Anyhow, it's a German company. T-Mobile is owned by a German company. Now Sprint's going to be owned by a Japanese company. It's like, who won World War II? In fact, there are so few American telecom companies and manufacturers that our nation will likely have to rely on foreign telecoms like China's Huawei to build the next generation of telecom infrastructure in the United States. That's how bad things have gotten for American industries. Consider this number. Every single second in America. Now, that phrase, every single second in America, was what, about 5 seconds? Every single second in America, over $4,000 worth of our industry is sold off to foreign investors. That's how rapidly America is being sold off. By the time we hit the next commercial break, over $3 million worth of American-owned industries will have been sold off to wealthy foreign investors. When Ronald Reagan came into the White House, we owned more foreign companies than any other country in the world. And now it's the reverse. Why? Because of Reaganomics, because of insane so-called free trade policies. Free trade policies that today are allowing us to be eaten alive by foreign transnationals. Trade policies that leave our nation with as much as an $800 billion annual trade deficit. Think about that. Every single year, we hand other nations $800 billion U.S. dollars in exchange for things we just as easily could have made here, but we bought from them. And since these are U.S. dollars, these foreign nations eventually have to spend that money someplace. And who issued that money? Oh, yeah, we did. So they have to come back to the United States to spend those dollars. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're buying up U.S. companies and buying up our commons. They're buying up Sprint. They already bought up T-Mobile. They're buying up parking meters in Chicago, water systems around the country, toll roads in Indiana, Virginia, Texas, not to mention tens of thousands of for-profit companies. They're buying up private charter schools to educate our kids. And each time a foreign company buys an American company or buys a chunk of our commons, that represents future profits getting sucked out of our economy and dropped into that foreign nation. But that's just one example of this foreign corporate takeover. Look at what's happening with the Canadian corporation TransCanada, the one that Mitt Romney loves so much. Hey, let's make North America energy independent. Well, North America includes Canada. The Canadian corporation TransCanada, which as we speak is bulldozing private property in Texas to build a massive pipeline across the United States down to the Gulf Coast where toxic tar sands oil will be refined and shipped all over the world. We get higher prices for gasoline and the pollution from refinery. We get to pay higher prices for gas. We get the pollution from the refining because the Canadians aren't stupid. They're not going to refine that junk in Canada. Canada gets the money from selling us the tar sands oil. And England, Brazil, and China get the gasoline and diesel fuel that these companies are going to export from our Gulf Coast. We talked about this last week. 78-year-old Eleanor Fairchild was arrested for trespassing on her own property as she tried to stop TransCanada's bulldozers, a Canadian company. She's in Texas. She tried to stop TransCanada's bulldozers from clearing away trees on her land. We are quickly becoming the world's mining and pollution waste pit. And while all Americans should be outraged by that, there are some American companies that are actively participating in this predation. And one of those companies is Bain Capital. Yep, that business that Mitt Romney started back in the 1980s and that he still gets a $90,000 a day paycheck from. Think about that for a minute. How much did you make last year? Mitt Romney makes $90,000 a day. He has made billions seizing control of American companies, gutting them, or at least his company has, gutting them, and then selling them off to foreign investors. And then they pay Mitt Romney $90,000 a day for that. In his own words, Mitt Romney described his business model at Bain as harvesting companies.
Bain Capital is an investment partnership which was formed to invest in startup companies and ongoing companies, then to take an active hand in managing them, and hopefully 5 to 8 years later to harvest them at a significant profit.
There you go. Today, one of those companies getting harvested is Sensata Technologies in Freeport, Illinois. Despite being more profitable than ever, Sensata's American factory is currently being deconstructed, taken apart, block by block, piece by piece, with its components being shipped off to China and all of its 170 workers set to lose their jobs at the end of the year, replaced by Chinese workers. No knock on China. This is the insane American trade policies. Remember the debate? Romney said, I don't know of any tax break companies get for shipping jobs overseas. Really? Well, that's the decision being made by Bain Capital. It's more profitable to send Sensata over to China. Bain Capital, after all, owns Sensata. Workers at the factory have been begging Mitt Romney to intervene to save their jobs, but he says no. He and the other corporate outsourcers are committed to getting all the short-term profits they can, even though it means the long-term death of the American economy. Welcome to Third World America, courtesy of Reagan, Clinton, and Bush's embrace of so-called free trade, and Obama's as well. We need to wake up. As Ross Perot back in 1992 was yelling about, we need to wake up and say, enough already, this is nuts. As Senator Bernie Sanders has said on this program over and over and over again for the 7 or 8 years that he has been on here every single Friday doing our national town hall meetings, our trade policies, these international trade policies, these free trade policies, they do not work for the American workers. They do not work for the American economy. They don't work for us. They only are hurting us. And it's time for us to wake up to it. I find it amazing. Mitt Romney's running around now. He's taking a China bashing, right? He's going to get tough on China. While Bain is shipping Sensata literally as we speak. Go to Bainport.com. The Sensata workers have occupied a fairgrounds across the street from the factory and renamed it Bainport. This is Freeport, Illinois. Bainport.com. And you can see the whole story. Bain is shipping a factory to a foreign country, to a low-wage country. Why? Because there's a tax advantage to them, because they can make more money doing it. Because they don't give a rat's patootie about American workers. And by the way, these people are not even, they've lost their severance pay now. In addition to everything else. Ain't Bain wonderful? Yeah. That guy should become president of the United States.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. What would you do to change our trade policies if you had a chance? Media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only, slightly unbalanced. Sister Karen Herring is with us. We'll have Nuns on the Bus. Nunsonthebus.org is the website. Sister Herring, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Nuns on the Bus became quite visible for a period of time when you were going through Wisconsin calling out Paul Ryan on his budget. What are you up to now?
Last Wednesday, we launched Nuns on the Bus Ohio, and we left from Cincinnati, and we went through Dayton, Lima, Columbus, Toledo, over to Fremont, Cleveland, down to Youngstown, Athens, and now we're back in Cincinnati.
Wow. What's your message?
So 1,000 miles in 5 days. The message is lift up the voice of poor people. We stopped at all the social service agencies where sisters have an influence or are running them, and heard the stories of many Ohioans in need who are being helped by the work of the sisters, literacy centers, clinics, immigration, ESOL places, Dorothy Day houses, where many of our citizens are getting the help they need, and many of these programs receive some grant funding from the federal and state government. And if the across-the-board budget cuts happen at the end of the year, many of these programs will have to cut programs and staff.
Well, so if I may, I don't think that the sequestration across the board cuts are going to happen at the end of the year. It may go to that, but they'll fix that a week or two after and put stuff back in. The problem is, if you have a Romney-Ryan administration, I mean, Paul Ryan is on the record. He's passed two budgets that have been voted on by all but seven Republicans in the House of Representatives that would cut many of those social programs that you're talking about. On the other hand, if you have an Obama administration, in all probability, they won't get cut. In fact, some of them may get enhanced. How does that reality, that assuming that you don't disagree with that characterization, how does that reality comport with what I believe to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, the desire of nuns on the bus to not be partisan, but rather to be issue-based?
We have said, we've quoted our Catholic bishops in saying that the budget passed by the House fails the moral test, and we are promoting the faithful budget, which was adopted by 55 groups, people of Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, who worked out this budget of principles, not of dollars. And so we're saying to people as we go around, no matter who is elected, tell your representatives that this is what the principles we want guiding the budget decisions that are made. How money is allocated has to benefit all citizens, not just the wealthy.
Right.
And that we have to keep holding their feet to the fire to say these are the values and the principles that across all faiths that we believe, that this country was founded one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all people.
When I was young, it was the Fathers Berrigan, the Brothers Berrigan. The Catholic Church and people within the Catholic Church have for so long, for so many generations, for so many hundreds, arguably thousands of years, been at the forefront of social justice movements and literally fulfilling Jesus' admonitions in both the Sermon on the Mount and Matthew 25. And I just want to tell you how much I honor you for doing that and for
You very much. That's why the sisters came to this country over 150, 200 years ago, some of them. They came to serve the poor immigrant population, to give them an education, to give them health care. And so we're still presenting the same message.
Are you all members? I'm not Catholic, and so my familiarity with the Catholic Church is, in large part, was informed by reading St. Teresa of Avila's Interior Castle and Dark Night of the Soul by St. John of the Cross, and which, of course, was from a very different era. They were associates. In fact, John got beat up pretty badly for going along with Teresa's attempts at reforming the church. Are you all from one order?
No, we're from many orders. There in Ohio, there must be more than two dozen orders.
Who are participating in Nuns on the Bus?
Right. So as we go from city to city, some sisters get on, some get off. But it's an inter-community effort. It's not a my order issue.
Yeah.
And it's a human issue. It goes beyond political party as well. It's not a single-issue campaign. It's a show me where you spend your money, and I'll tell you what your values are. Don't tell me your values. Show me how you spend your money.
Amen.
And as a country, we've got to say we care for all of our citizens and how we allocate our budget.
Yes,
the faithful budget can be summarized in five words: reasonable revenue for responsible programs. Get rid of the waste. Get rid of the fraud. But also get the reasonable revenue, not tax breaks for the wealthy balanced on the backs of the poor. Everybody pays a share according to their ability.
Sister, I'm just totally off topic. I'm curious if you knew my old friend, Brother Wayne Teasdale.
No, I didn't. I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's passed on. He was quite prominent in the Catholic Church. Anyway, we're talking with Sister Karen Herring, and Sister Karen is a Sister of Mercy for over 50 years. NunsOnTheBus.org is the organization. NunsBusOhio is the Twitter, @NunsBusOhio, and campaigning for the 99%, actually for the 100%, for all of us. Is that accurate?
That's right.
Yes. And it's absolutely marvelous what you're doing, and people can support you by going to nunsonthebus.org, I'm assuming.
Find out what you're up to.
And great. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Sister. Is it appropriate to call you Sister Karen or Sister Herring?
Either is fine.
Okay. Thank you very much. As I learn my
thank
way through
you
this, having been raised Methodist,
the common good as well.
Amen. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And keep up the great work. We will be back here on the Tom Hartman Program, 27 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So what would you do to stop the outsourcing of America? How do we bring an economy back to this country? That's the good, the bad, and the very, very horrifically ugly. The good. The American people. On Saturday, around 1,000 Americans laid down on a beach in San Francisco and spelled out the words, Dump Citizens United. The spectacular protest was just the latest in a long line of protests across America ever since the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in 2010. Since then, millionaires and billionaires have systematically taken over our government and our democracy using their corporate cash to try and silence the voices of you and me. Brad Newsham, a San Francisco cabbie who organized the protest, told reporters the 2010 Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United trampled on America's founding principles, swamped our democracy and corporate cash, and needs to be overturned. End quote. Mr. Newsham and the protesters who showed up on Saturday know that corporations are not people, no matter what Mitt Romney says, and money is not speech. It's time we overturned Citizens United and got our voices back. The bad, Jason Thompson. Thompson, the son of Tommy Thompson, a Republican running for Congress from Wisconsin, spoke at a Republican Party of Kenosha County brunch event Sunday morning. During his speech, Thompson had some interesting words for brunchgoers.
We have the opportunity to send President Obama back to Chicago, or Kenya.
I don't know if you caught that at the very end. Back to Chicago or Kenya. Yep, another conservative using racial undertones and playing on this absurd conspiracy theory that the president is not an American. We shouldn't be surprised, though. Conservatives all across the country know they don't have a record to run on, so instead they play the conspiracy theory card to try to win over America's votes. Let's not let that strategy work come November. And the very, very ugly Janice Lane. Lane is the president of the Central Mississippi Tea Party, and in an interview with the Jackson Free Press, Lane said that, quote, I'm really going to set you back here. Probably the biggest turn we ever made was when women got the right to vote, end quote. Lane went on to say, quote, our country might have been better off if it was still just men voting, end quote. Lane even went on to say that women are mean, hateful, and diabolical, and if those comments weren't enough, Lane finished the interview by saying, I'd much rather have a male boss than a female boss. Double-minded, you can never trust them. This is a woman. Ms. Lane's feelings for her own gender aside, she wants to take America back to the days when only white male property owners had a say in the American democracy, and that is very, very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly.
Lois in Pittsville, Wisconsin. Hey, Lois, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hi. No, it's Rose.
Oh, Rose, I'm sorry. So what's up, Rose?
Yeah, I just wanted to say what an inspiration that Dave Friends was.
The owner of Carbonite, or the CEO of Carbonite.
I'm hoping more companies following his footsteps.
I absolutely agree. When he told me that story a week or so ago, I came back and I told you the story on the air, and I just thought that was so good, and we just had to get him on to tell it. Hopefully more American companies will do that, because we need to be bringing back not just our customer service. We need to be bringing back our manufacturing. Now, Carbonite doesn't do manufacturing, but we need to, the manufacturing businesses, we need to be providing tax incentives to those companies to bring them back, and we need to defund the incentives for companies to move their business offshore, which is something that Nancy Pelosi actually got passed out of the House of Representatives, and it got filibustered by the Republicans in the Senate. So thank you very much, Rose, for your
I have one more question
sure.
for you. Could you kind of fill me back in on the charter school topic that you had on earlier?
Sure. What about it?
Well, I wanted to know, is it in California, Florida? Where was it?
The one that we were talking about where the Chinese had invested in 30 charter schools and they were planning on spending $30 million, I believe it was, and they were going to – actually, hang on just a second. I got the numbers right here. Maybe I don't. It's in Florida, first of all. Yeah, it is in Florida. I'm hearing shouts from the next room. And I thought it was in our newscast, but apparently it's not. So, but yeah, it's in Florida, and there's another large investment coming. But it's not just Chinese. I mean, it's all over. And this is the problem when you try to when you privatize the commons, whether it's your roads, whether it's your highways, whether it's your bridges, whether it's your water systems, your power systems, your schools, your police departments, your fire departments, you privatize them, you're putting them in the control of somebody else who may have as their primary motive profit. And if that profit then goes outside the United States, we get hurt twice. And, first when the profit is taken out of the community and second when it's taken out of the country. And they also may have, in the case of some countries, they may have an agenda of having some control over those commons, and that may not be a good thing for the United States. Frankly, I don't think it's a good thing for any country. I think every country should own and protect its own commons, and it should ring-fence them. So, Rose, thank you very much for the call. Very, very nice to hear from you. Eric in Los Angeles. Hey, Eric, what's
up? Hi there. I've been thinking, if I could ask just one question to Mitt Romney at a town hall meeting, what would it be?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have come to a conclusion what I'd ask. For the last 10 years, we've been fighting two wars, and they've not only cost us terribly wounded and deaths, but also trillions of dollars to pay for everything they need. The weapons, the body armor, the medical care, even the artificial limbs. And in all of those 10 years, you did everything you could, even putting your money offshore so you could pay as little as you could.
The you you're talking about being Mitt Romney.
I'm definitely not talking about you. I'm talking about Mitt
Romney. I do not have an offshore account. So yeah.
There you go. I'm glad. So my question to Mr. Romney is, how do you justify that, leaving the rest of us to pay even more for our wars?
Yeah. Somehow, Eric, I think that's probably one of the most important questions, particularly since in the first debate, Romney said, I think in an unguarded moment, he was actually quoting, paraphrasing scripture. He said, where your money is, there will your heart be, right? And I mean, that's pretty much word for word what Romney said, at which point Obama could have said, but I think the moment got lost and it was just a piece of a larger thing, but Obama could have said, yeah, and where's your money? But,
so, Tom,
yeah.
If you think this aspect resonates, and in the next 3 weeks, I hope that you'll tell your contacts to resonate it.
Yeah, there you go. Will do. Eric, thank you very much for the call. Tim in Ann Arbor. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm bringing up the presidential debates. It's been bugging me ever since the first debate. But, the presidential debates, the way they're structured in the modern day here on the 21st century, they're totally useless. It's all style. No substance. It's just hoops that both candidates have to jump through. I'm glad Joe Biden won the last one, but I don't really get rid of debates or go back to something ideally like maybe what Lincoln Douglas debates were back in the.
You know, the Lincoln Douglas debate was, as I recall, 5 hours long and lasted 3 days. I mean, it was some huge thing.
Well, there was a thing on television the other night. It was Lawrence O'Donnell. I'll just bring his name up.
Yeah, I saw it.
And he had a solution to the debates. and it made sense. But I already knew it, but he just totally reconvinced me that, you know, the debates are useless.
Right. We don't elect a debater in chief. The job of the President of the United States does not include debating. And therefore, to use the ability of somebody to win in a debate as a criteria for selecting a president is kind of dumb. On the other hand, we've got to figure out a way to come up with some kind of contrast between the people running for President of the United States. And there have been presidential debates. I mean, going back to the early 19th century. I mean, you know, for 200 years we've been having presidential debates. So I'm with you that this whole soundbite thing and 22 pages of rules and what they can't say and they can say and all that, that's nonsense. I agree with Lawrence's op-ed. I thought it was very well said. Thanks, Tim, for the call. But let's hope that particularly if Candy Crowley sticks by her guns and inserts herself into this debate rather than being a Jim Lehrer type potted plant, that's a little more light than heat will come out of this, although I realize that the heat sells, but I'd like to see it happen. John in Rochester, New York. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I was going to talk a few moments about the idea of being told you have to or asked by a business to follow a certain, you know, voting measure or stand behind them in a photo and such like that.
Right.
This is what unions are for.
Yep.
Unions keep that from occurring, keep them from controlling you and telling you anything but working.
Unions level the playing field between the power of aggregated capital and the power of aggregated labor. That's the whole point of a union.
And the people out there who say, oh, you can't fire someone, you can't do this, you can't. Yes, you can. You have to work to fire someone. I can't disagree, but that means they have to do something wrong. Not just you don't like them or you didn't like the way they voted or they didn't give to the party you gave to. You can't use those silly reasons. You've got to actually find them doing something wrong.
And here's probably the most important thing, John. We all give all this lip service to democracy, and I find it astounding how much Republicans love to give lip service to freedom and democracy and, you know, small-d democracy. And workplaces are not democratic institutions. They're kingdoms. But unions are democratic institutions. The workers themselves vote even on the existence of the union. Then they vote on the leadership. Then they vote on the rules. Then they vote on the actions. Everything is a vote. Unions are democracy in the workplace. Thanks, John.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Which may have something to do with why those countries, like the Scandinavian countries that are not experiencing the worldwide meltdown, have unionization rates in the 80s and 90s.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. 10 minutes before the hour. James in Detroit, Michigan, listening to WDTW AM 1310. James, what's on your mind?
Yeah, just one real quick thing. Why don't we dump the Republicans and bring back the Whigs?
You know?
They were right about a lot of things. Internal improvements, high tariffs.
Well, the Republicans were, too.
The American system.
The Republicans supported high tariffs right up until the Nixon administration.
Yeah, well, then they went crazy after Reagan.
Yeah, by and large. I mean, you know, they started it, the process started Nixon opening China on behalf of Pepsi, but it really went on steroids. But yeah, I'm with you, James. You are the lucky winner of a copy of if you would like it, a copy of Rebooting the American Dream: 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country by me, as autographed by the author. Would you like one?
Oh, that's awesome.
Okay, Shano just picked you out randomly. This is, by the way, sponsored by Stamps.com, who will be covering the postage to get it to you. James is on line 3, Shane. Let Danielle know so she can pick up the call and get James's information so we can ship the book to him. Thank you, James, and congratulations. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I just want to follow up with Rose, who called about 3 or 4 calls earlier about the charter schools.
Yeah.
CBS did a 60 Minutes did an expose last May 13th, 2012. U.S. charter schools tied to powerful Turkish imam, and basically how this relates to the Sensata issue is that in both cases, whether it's a Turkish charter school or whether it's Sensata, They're bringing in these foreign workers on these alphabet soup visa programs to either take jobs from American teachers or to help facilitate offshoring of jobs. We know this to be axiomatic.
Yeah.
The Kamal Nath, the Indian Commerce Minister, in a 2007 story in the New York Times, he said, the H-1B visa has become the outsourcing visa, said Kamal Nath, the then Commerce Minister of India.
Right. It's how people would come over here. They would get a job for a year or two. They would learn the industry, and they would learn, you know, everything, and then they go back to India and do it.
And in March of 2012, the New York Times had a story how India became an outsourcing magnet.
Yeah.
So we have to be asking these politicians, how come in this high level of unemployment we're allowing over a million foreign legal workers still every year? And to Romney, what visa programs are you using, is Bain using, to come bring these foreign scab workers over from China? And you had Senator Durbin on earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at his voting record, Senator Durbin comes across as this avuncular, nice guy, but most of his voting record in Congress has been voting for an increase in foreign workers coming over here, and nobody's been asking him about this.
Yeah, okay. Well, I did not know that, and I think that it's something that would be a, you know, probably a reasonable thing to ask him. But not so much in Senator Durbin's defense, but let me just say, this has been a bipartisan problem. Both Republicans and Democrats have been supporting these free trade deals and these visa deals. And I think that I keep saying the first party that starts talking about going back to tariffs is going to be the first party that's going to start seriously winning elections. Ross Perot proved that he got almost 20% of the vote. That 20% of the vote could be going to one of the two parties. And I don't understand. Well, I do understand. I know why neither of the parties have been grabbing that vote. It's because there's so much money sloshing around in this town, which is just tragic. Ed in Moundsville, West Virginia. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind?
Well, you wanted to know what would I do about stopping this outsourcing?
Yes, sir.
I'd charge them about 25% tax if they did it. And on top of that, they would have to supply a job for the people that loses their job for their outsourcing.
Well, you know, 25% is actually lower than what the average tariff was in the United States from the George Washington administration to the Ronald Reagan administration.
Well,
the average in America was 31% during that period of time.
But
I'm with you.
And I don't care, but raise the taxes so high that it doesn't pay them to do it. And on top of that, they have to give everybody a job or find them a job making as much money as they're making on the job that they're going to lose.
Yeah.
Or they can't do it.
I'm totally with you. Thanks very much, Ed, for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Rob, listening to WCPT. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Love
Good.
Your show.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm calling because half an hour ago, while I was listening to you, I received a phone call from a survey company, and it was the typical questions, you know, age, race, your political affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
And as they answered all the questions at the end, they said, well, in order to prove to my boss that I spoke to you, I need your name, please. And I found that very unusual.
Really?
Yeah. So I gave him my first name, and he said, and your last name as well. And I said, why do you need my last name? And he said, so I can prove to my boss that I spoke to you. And I said, well, you can't have my last name.
You are the victim of somebody who's up to no good.
Exactly.
This might be Themis, you know, the giant database that the Koch brothers are building or something. I mean, who knows? But Rob, thanks for the heads up on that. Jerry in Minneapolis, listening on KTNF. Hey, Jerry, last minute of the show, it's yours.
Yeah, you mentioned the credit card thing. When my mother was a member of AFSCME, the public union,
mm-hmm.
they had a credit card where all the call-ins were in the U.S., so you might want to do like the occupier people and switch your bank or switch your credit card to something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, you know, I did that when I was in Portland. I joined a credit union while we were there, and we started doing all our banking with the credit union. I was a member of it. It was just a wonderful thing. We moved out to Washington, and we kept some small amount of money in one of the big banks. Moved out to D.C., and I just haven't gotten around to getting out there. It's You know, Louise and I both work 12-hour days, 5 days a week. That's a lousy excuse, I will be the first to say. But you're right. I do need to do that and get with a credit union or a smaller bank. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, President Obama meets Mitt Romney on tomorrow night. And we will be for the second presidential candidates and in New York, in fact. We'll have a preview. Plus, do the debates really matter? Should we do away with them? I'll challenge conservative Curtis Sliwa. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.